Seekers, because I fucking love you, here's part two of that three-part special Conspiracy Month bonus show just for you.
Robert Mayer's witty and riveting novel, IJFK, in which the young president dictates from heaven his memories of the days of Camelot, performed by Bruce Watson and Paula Strongheart Garfield.
Note also the little details so beloved in film noir. The middle name of the central character, for instance, James R. Hoffa, R for Riddle. Why did the teamster cross the road? To plunder the pension fund. By the start of 1957, as I've said, my own course had been set, a four-year marathon run for the presidency. Bobby had no such course, no such star to guide him. He was still the Democratic counsel of the Investigations Committee, but he needed an issue into which he could really sink his teeth. He found that issue in the outrageous corruption of the Teamsters Union. He sank his teeth into the fleshy butt of Jimmy Hoffa. For the next 11 years, they would go through life that way. The corrupt union official alternately running and turning to fight, Bobby hanging onto his bloody butt like a bulldog with rabies. The first person Bobby nailed was the union's president, Dave Beck. It was like taking candy from a baby. Unfortunately, the baby was followed, as a union head, by the bathwater, Jimmy Hoffa. As vice president, it was Hoffa who had been responsible for most of the dirty work. He had made his own pact years before with organized crime in Detroit. The mob would help Hoffa climb to the top of the union. In return, the mob would have access to the Teamsters' pension fund. The first face-to-face meeting between Bobby and Hoffa took place the night of February 19, 1957. It was at the home of a Teamster attorney, Eddie Chaffetz. They were like two boxers sizing each other up before a fight, and it was a strange match. Hoffa, squat and strong and talking tough. Bobby, short and wiry, but talking just as tough. Hoffa got in the first jab.
I do to others what they do to me, only worse.
Maybe I should have worn my bulletproof vest, Bobby countered. Neither one seemed intimidated.
You're a damn spoiled jerk. You and your brother both. Rich kids. You never had to do an honest day's work in your life.
And you are pure evil. Part of a wicked conspiracy using force or the threat of force for extortion.
Offends your sensibilities, does it, little Bobby? Huh? How come when you were a kid you dressed up as a girl, huh? I guess you were a homo is why?
I've got a wife and kids. You've got a mistress who sleeps with the mob. After that, the level of discourse deteriorated.
I know what I want, and I'll do anything that's necessary to get it. That's the only way for a real man to live.
You remind me of something rank and slimy.
Oh, I remind you of your father?
The judges ruled this first confrontation a draw. The next morning, Bobby was awakened by a telephone call from Hoffa.
You're going to make your brother president over my dead body.
Well, I can damn well try. Bobby hung up, feeling pleased with himself. My first big step toward the presidency was in losing the vice presidential nomination to Kefauver in 56. Had I been on the ticket, my national career would have been over, and no Catholic would have been nominated for another 30 years. My second big step toward the presidency was in defeating Kefauver early in 56 for a vacant seat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the prestigious platform I needed. I gave a ringing speech attacking the Eisenhower administration for its support of the French war in Algeria. The speech won attention nationwide. Then came the missile gap, as dramatized by Sputnik. At first, I hit upon missile gap speeches as a way to garner some defense contracts for Massachusetts. But it soon became clear that the phrase itself touched a nerve in the American psyche.
Made it sound like America had been castrated, Lyndon said. And by God, we was gonna get our peckers back.
Lyndon surprises with his psychological insight sometimes. I was also on the McClellan Committee, where Bobby was going after the Teamsters. Pop was against this, saying it would turn organized labor against us in the 60s election. He was wrong again. The televised hearings with Bobby, the tousled head kid, going up against the fat cat mob-controlled union leaders, won Bobby his own following, both good and bad. The good, the gutsy Kennedys, fighting corruption everywhere they found it, rubbed off on me as well. The bad, charges that Bobby was a ruthless interrogator, clearly did not apply to a smiling Jack. The result was a barrage of national magazine articles about the fighting Kennedys, unequaled since the fighting Sullivans of World War II. You name the magazine, they wrote us up. The most prescient was the following paragraph. It appeared in an article called The Amazing Kennedys. Fervent admirers of the Kennedys, the article said, profess to see in their national prominence the flowering of another great political family. They confidently look forward to the day when Jack will be in the White House, Bobby will serve in the cabinet as Attorney General, and Teddy will be the senator from Massachusetts. How's that for 2020 foresight? Jackie and I had a child at last. We named her Caroline. In a family that bred like rabbits, it should have been no major event, but for us, it was exhilarating. After a miscarriage and then a stillbirth, one begins to question the prices life will charge. Politically, it would have been a blessing as well, the family man. But looking at that tiny face, I gave no thought to politics. Not that we wouldn't give new meaning later on to the photo opportunity. Bobby and his committee went after Jimmy Hoffa with 2 years of on-and-off public hearings. One day during this time, a fellow named Joey Gallo appeared in Bobby's office. He was a New York mobster, the head of an enforcer union. He was dressed appropriately in a black shirt, black pants, and a black coat. The first thing he did was kneel down and feel the rug.
Hey, this'd be nice for a crap game,
Gallo mused. Someone with unrelated business entered the office. Joey Gallo leaped up, grabbed the man, frisked him thoroughly. Then he explained to Bobby's startled staff.
No one with a gun on him is going to see Mr. Kennedy. If Kennedy gets killed now, everybody will say I did it. Huh? I am not going to take that rap.
It was no idle fear. Gallo was already a suspect in a murder in which the victim had been shot repeatedly in the face. On the witness stand at the hearings, Gallo took the Fifth Amendment on every single question. In the corridor afterward, he told Bobby,
I'll line up my people for your brother in 1960.
Good old reliable Joey. The details of the hearings had been related at length elsewhere. Of most interest here, perhaps, some of the dramatis personae upon whom Bobby pounced. Among them were Paul Red Dorfman. Red took over the Waste Handlers Union in Chicago in 1939 after its president was murdered. Among those picked up by police for questioning in that murder was the union's local secretary, Jack Rubenstein. If you haven't already guessed, that worthy gentleman later changed his name to Jack Ruby and moved to Dallas. Momo Salvatore Sam Giancana, the mob boss of Chicago, was described by Bobby at the hearing as a chief gunman for the group that succeeded the Capone mob. Friend to Frank Sinatra, lover to singer Phyllis McGuire, excerpt sample from his testimony. Bobby first. Would you tell us, if you have opposition from anybody, do you dispose of them by having them stuffed in a trunk?
I decline to answer, because I honestly believe my answer might tend to incriminate me.
My re-election to the Senate in 1958 was a simple matter. Our main goal was to really roll up the vote and thus attract the attention of politicians across the country. Pop spent $1.5 million on the campaign. I spoke everywhere in Massachusetts, taking nothing for granted. I rolled up 73.6% of the vote, a record for the Commonwealth. It was clear to everyone what we were doing, of course, and there was no point in being coy about it. As 1960 began, I waited for as long as I could contain myself before making the formal announcement in the Senate caucus room that I was candidate for president. There were, we knew, three main obstacles in the way of my winning the nomination. The party bosses were against me. At 43, I would be considered too young, and I was a Catholic. The only way to overcome all these handicaps, we decided, was to enter as many state primaries as possible and win them all. Our main opponent in the primaries would be Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota. Adlai had made it clear he would not campaign for the nomination for a third time, but made it equally clear he would gladly accept a draft. But in the end, Bobby predicted early on, our strongest rival would be Lyndon Johnson of Texas. The first primary was in New Hampshire, in my own backyard. Uncontested, no problem. I called Judy Campbell, whom Sinatra had introduced me to 3 weeks before in Vegas. I'd been phoning her ever since, but we had not yet gotten together. I made a date to meet her the night before the primary, March 7th, at the Plaza Hotel in New York. It would be our first real date and an earlier celebration of my New Hampshire victory. So as not to attract attention, I booked a room under a phony name, George Washington. From an uncontested victory in New Hampshire, we moved west to the first confrontation of the primaries, Wisconsin. It was right in Hubert's backyard, and it would be a real struggle. We mobilized all the troops, Bobby, Teddy, Gene, Pat, Eunice, etc., even Mom. Only Pop stayed home, discreetly out of the limelight, discreetly non-controversial. He did send his money, however. We got ourselves a campaign plane with which to crisscross the state and dubbed it the Caroline. It was a Kennedy Blitz, we hoped. By beating Hubert so close to his home state, we could drive him out of the race right there. Poor Hubert. He was one of the brightest minds in the Senate, one of the most stem-winding speakers, and one of the nicest guys. He'd won national attention for his ringing declarations on civil rights way back in 1948, when half the Democratic Party still owned slaves. But we had him outmanned, outwomaned, and outspent. On primary day, we won a narrow victory. It should have been glorious, but it was sour. The newspapers printed maps of the state broken up along religious lines. They showed that our margin of victory had come entirely from the heavily Catholic areas of the state. It was termed a Catholic victory, and that meant we would have to do it all over again in every primary all the way to the convention. Hubert, buoyed by the closeness of the vote, vowed to press on. It was this decision, in a curious way, that would win me the nomination. If Humphrey had dropped out after Wisconsin, there would have been no more contests in which to show I could win, in which to prove to the party bosses the voters didn't really fear that Kennedy would mean a papal presidency. But Humphrey announced he would take us on head-on again in the next primary. At first, we were jubilant. West Virginia was only 3% Catholic, the smallest percentage of any state in the Union. But a poll we'd taken in December had shown us running ahead there by a whopping 70-30 margin. A win like that in that state would dispel all doubts. As we entered the state in the spring, to rev up the campaign, we took another poll. This time, it showed Humphrey winning 60-40. What the hell happened between December and now? In December, somebody replied, nobody here knew you were a Catholic. In West Virginia, a Catholic couldn't be elected dog catcher. Bobby, my campaign manager, nearly went into shock. I called Pop in Palm Beach and gave him the grim assessment.
Well, I guess it's a good thing you're not running for dog catcher, he said.
West Virginia, the bone crusher of the campaign. How did we ever win in West Virginia? Let me count the ways. First, Pop had one of the most brilliant ideas of his life. He asked Franklin D. Roosevelt, Jr. to campaign for us in West Virginia. Pop knew FDR's son from the old days. He also knew that in the pantheon of the state, there was no god higher than Roosevelt. He'd been the coal miner's best friend, if you don't count Eleanor. And there were more bridges, tunnels, and streets named after him than in any other state of the Union. Go into the grubbiest shack in the tiniest mountain holler, and you were sure to find a faded picture of FDR hanging in the place of honor. We printed up an endorsement of me by Franklin Jr., and again at Pop's suggestion, mailed them out from the Roosevelt Ancestral Home in Hyde Park, New York. Then Jr. came in person and crisscrossed the state, looking and sounding much like his father. As things warmed up, he cited my record in World War II and claimed that Hubert had avoided service by dodging the draft. This was not true, of course, but it was quite effective. The second way that we won in West Virginia was in the area of religion. Our first game plan had been to ignore the religious issue here and just hope that it would go away. But I soon realized that it wouldn't. Nobody was mentioning it, but everybody was thinking about it. On one of the first days of campaigning, I was standing on the steps of a building, holding a microphone, speaking to a few hundred people. Someone in the crowd shouted out a question about religion. Instead of shrinking from it, I instinctively met the issue head on. I am a Catholic, but the fact that I was born a Catholic, does that mean that I can't be President of the United States? I am able to serve in Congress, and my brother was able to give his life, but we can't be president? As I said the words aloud, I felt myself tingle. More important, I could feel the whole crowd tingle. This was what was really on their minds. They wanted to hear me talk about it. If I am elected president, I will not take orders from any pope, cardinal, bishop, or priest. That is my vow to you. I ask only in return that each and every one of you play fair when you enter the voting booths. The crowd cheered wildly. We moved on to the next town and the next. At every speech thereafter, we made sure that someone in the crowd brought up the issue of religion. Then I could answer it. I would stand in the spring sunshine, the wind blowing my hair, and I would look out at the crowd, and up above a glowing white dove would spell out against the clear blue sky, visible only to me, the words of my answer, the words that would still their prejudice, the words that would win their hearts. When we beat him in West Virginia, Hubert was through. I was watching a porn film in Washington when the returns came in. From then on, we rolled across the country, winning in Nebraska, Maryland, Oregon. When the convention opened in Los Angeles the second week of July, I already had pledged to me 550 of the 761 votes needed to win. We knew I had to win on the first ballot or risk losing the momentum and the committed delegates. Word spewed out of Las Vegas that the odds there heavily favored my winning. No one knew that Pop, on his way west, had stopped there and plunked $1 million down on me to create just such a story. At the convention, Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota made the best nominating speech in the history of politics. Unfortunately, he was nominating not me, but Adlai. The convention galleries went wild. They cheered, they screamed, they paraded through the aisles for half an hour while the bands played on. Adlai had their hearts, their minds. The only thing he didn't have was delegates. Our real opposition was Lyndon. He was encouraging votes for Adlai on the first ballot to stop us. Then he'd move in himself. It was the game of a riverboat gambler, and there was no one better at it, except me. On nomination night, I watched the balloting on television from a nearby apartment. Wyoming put us over the top. Everyone crowded around, shaking my hand. Jackie was not in L.A. that night, the night the dreams of four generations of Kennedys moved one step closer to being real. Judy was. I hurried to the convention hall. I had a private moment with Bobby in the corridor while everyone stayed back watching us. Then I mounted the podium. I accepted the adoration of the crowd. Facing me was the first crucial decision every nominee has to make, who to choose as running mate. From San Antonio, we flew the afternoon of the 21st to Houston, where I planned to speak that night at a testimonial dinner for the Representative Albert Thomas, the key man in congressional approval of my costly space program. When NASA chose Houston as the site of its new manned space center, it listed all sorts of technical reasons for the choice, but the real reason was to keep Albert Thomas happy. Houston was the congressman's hometown. The crowds there were even bigger than in San Antonio. I asked Dave Powers how they compared with those on my last visit to the city in 1962. Dave told me, "Your crowd here today was about the same as last year's, but 100,000 more people came out to cheer for Jackie." Once upon a distant time, in the wealthy kingdom of us, there was a sweet and beautiful princess known as Miss Liberty. She was so fragile, she always needed a powerful guardian to make sure no enemy stole her away. For 8 years, while Miss Liberty slept uneasily, her guardian was kindly old Grandpa Ike, a once fierce warrior who was growing old and forgetful. When it was time for Grandpa Ike to retire, a new warrior had to be chosen to guard Miss Liberty. The leading contender was Grandpa Ike's nephew, Richard the Stubble-Hearted. For 8 years, Richard had served as Lord Veep, the second in command, Now he wanted to become the king. But some in the kingdom feared that Richard the Stubble-hearted had done savory designs on Miss Liberty, that she would not be safe in his hands. There were persistent tales that he had violated some of her sisters in the Land of Orange before he became Lord Veep. A faction of the kingdom, therefore, nominated their own candidate to vie for the throne. His name was Handsome Jack. The contenders would enter the lists, each with one mighty warrior at his side. His choice to be the next Lord Veep. Stubbleheart's warrior was Henry Cabot the Lodge. Now Handsome Jack had to select his own second in command. Lyndon moves closer. He takes off his stocking cap. I do believe his eyes are watering. The night he was nominated to vie for the throne, Handsome Jack retired alone to his apartment. He'd had little time to consider his choice for Lord Veep. Now he must decide quickly. Like a bolt from the blue, a wild idea came over him. What if he chose Lyndon, Bane of Texas? The Bane was one of the most powerful warriors in the land. If Handsome Jack became king, it would be far better to have the Bane at his side than as an enemy. Also, Jack came from the Northland and the Bane from the Southland. Together, they would have a better chance of uniting the country in opposition to Richard Stubble. And that was the Holy Grail, to make sure that the Stubble did not get his dirty paws on Miss Liberty. Now, Handsome Jack was a sly fellow, slyer than most people thought. For he further reasoned thusly, I will offer the lordship to the Bane. If he accepts, I will have a mighty warrior to enter the lists with me against Stubble. Most likely, however, he will decline. Most likely, he would rather remain the powerful Bane of Texas than the more honorary but less powerful Lord Veep. In that case, if he declines, I shall have won his loyalty merely by making the offer, and I can still enter the lists with Stuart Symington or some other worthy nobleman at my side.
But the Bane didn't decline.
Are you telling this, Lyndon, or am I?
Let me tell my part. The noble Bane confounded everybody and accepted the Veepship. For he reasoned thus and so. As Bane, I am very powerful, but I am considered a regional Bane. If I ever hope to be king, I will need the national following that as Lord Veep I could achieve. Also, my Baneship would be less powerful with Handsome Jack as king than it was under Grandpa Ike. So he sent Handsome Jack a copy of his family crest, the letters LBJ, and told him it now stood for Let's Back Jack, and he accepted the lordship. Among Handsome Jack's followers, the most concerned was his chief aide and brother, Robert the Younger. The next morning, Robert the Younger came to see the powerful Bane. Robert told the Bane that Handsome Jack had only been making a noble gesture, which was supposed to have been declined. That there was opposition to the Bane among the other nobles, that if he persisted in accepting, there would be a terrible, awesome fight at the round table. The Bane put on an air of sadness, then an air of bravery.
I love a good fight. Jack and I will fight them together.
And he refused to decline the offer. Jack and the Bane went on to massacre Stubbleheart and Cabot the Lodge and save the honor of Miss Liberty. That's what I call a happy ending. Nixon, of course, was merely defeated, not slain. He would live to paw Miss Liberty another day. That is the difference between life and fairy tales. In life, it's the heroes who die. With Lyndon in place as my running mate, I went before the convention to formally accept the nomination for president. It was in this nationally televised address that I first used the term New Frontier. Though I didn't much care for slogans, I liked its echoes of Roosevelt's New Deal and Truman's Fair Deal. In retrospect, it also conjures the image of outlaw gunslingers, an association that escaped me at the time. In my speech, I sounded a rhythmic ringing call for the pursuit of excellence in all phases of American life. Ever since Joe's death, I had been groomed to be president someday, with no higher purpose than the pursuit of power, the fulfilling of Pop's hubris. Now, it was as if, with the presidency in sight, I needed at last to form a vision of it, to synthesize my dual nature of power and poetry, to conjure what kind of president I was going to be. What I hit upon was nothing less than an American Renaissance, over which I would preside like a Medici prince. I would go down in history as the greatest president since Lincoln, perhaps the greatest of all. Such would be my monumental quest. In 1954, the leftist government in Guatemala had been overthrown by the Central Intelligence Agency. This was common knowledge to everyone but the American people. I was tempted to bring this up in the campaign, but I couldn't. I would be accused of revealing state secrets, even of treason. What I did not know then was that even as the campaign began, this same CIA was plotting the assassination of Fidel Castro. After taking office in January, I would be briefed on the details, but the plotting began that August. "The f***ing incompetence!" Bobby shouted. "Bad enough the agency got involved with the mob. You'd think the least somebody could do was pull it off. If they'd succeeded in killing Fidel, everything might have turned out differently." This iceberg of madness lay, of course, below the tranquil surface. All the American people saw that autumn of 1960 was me and Nixon running for president, a lapsed Catholic versus a devout paranoid. There were three critical moments during the campaign: my appearance before the Houston ministers, the first debate, and my call to Coretta King. Bigotry is one of the two great engines that drive the American reality, the other being violence. While I crisscrossed the country speaking of hopes and dreams, the engine of bigotry continued to grind among the electorate. One typical example was a statement in early September from the Good Baptists of Arkansas. "We cannot turn our government over to a Catholic president who would be influenced by the Pope." Jackie found the issue highly ironic.
"You're such a lousy Catholic. Now, if it was Bobby..."
When the issue wouldn't go away, we decided we had to confront it head on. One way would be to follow Jackie's line of reasoning. I could, for instance, distance myself from Catholic dogma by confessing to all my adulteries. Somehow that didn't seem like the high road. Instead, I agreed to answer all questions about religion at a televised meeting with a group of ministers in Houston. I gave a dramatic speech about the separation of church and state, declaring that I would resign the presidency before I would permit religious pressure to violate the national interest or my own conscience. When the television networks first suggested a debate between me and Tricky Dicky, I accepted immediately. Nixon was ahead in the polls. After 8 years as vice president, he was better known nationally, and he was presenting himself as much more experienced in foreign affairs. I had nothing to lose in a debate, and a lot to gain if I merely came off as his equal. The first debate was held on December 26th. It would not only turn the election around, but also turn American politics around. It was from that night on that what a politician stood for became far less important in winning elections than how he looked on television. The things we said that night are of little consequence. In fact, most people who heard the debate on the radio felt that Nixon had won. Most pundits the next morning, paying attention to the words, called it a draw. But 70 million people saw the debate on television, and the images they saw were Smilin' Jack versus Uriah Heep. My hands were shaking, but I could hide those behind the lectern. Nixon had put on a lot of makeup to hide his jowls, and beneath the hot lights he began to sweat like a horse. I looked calm and confident. Nixon looked almost pathetic. The next morning, as I resumed the campaign, people began to rip at my clothing, my cufflinks. I had become overnight the James Dean of politics.
"Jack!"
Yes, Martin?
"You forgot something. You left out the call to Coretta."
"I didn't forget. I'm merely pausing. For effect."
"Oh."
I have an idea. Perhaps you'd like to tell about it."
"Me? Well, would that really be okay?"
Be my guest. Martin clears his throat, rises to his full imposing height. He stares out majestically at the vast and sweeping eternity of clouds.
Ah, have a dream!
Martin.
Sorry, Jack. The date was October 19th. I was attempting to integrate a department store in Atlanta by sitting in. Predictably, I was arrested by the Atlanta police. The authorities soon released me, but 6 months earlier, I had been put on probation by a judge in DeKalb County for a traffic violation. Now, that judge took his new opportunity and had me arrested for parole violation, and he sentenced me to 4 months at hard labor. Now, that might not sound like much nowadays, especially to you folks up north, but in those days in the South, it was like sentencing a man to death. They woke me up 4:30 in the morning. They put me in handcuffs and leg irons. They took me from the county jail out dark, dirty country roads to some obscure jail deep in the rural outback. Once them white prisoners learned who I was, a shiv in the back by the decent white folks was a strong possibility. Coretta was near hysterical. Somebody got word to the Kennedys, suggested that a call from Jack, some reassurance from the presidential candidate, might help her to calm down. Jack's advisors warned him against it, told him a call to Coretta just then, 3 weeks before Election Day, would cost him the whole South and the presidency. But Jack disagreed. He got Coretta on the phone and he talked to her. Bobby was also worried about the political implications, but he was even more worried about me. He got that judge from DeKalb County on the phone and expressed some opinions about the notion of hard labor instead of bail for a traffic violation. I wouldn't be surprised if he also hinted that the judge might be looked on with disfavor should the Kennedys win the election. Whatever he said, I was released the next day. The best part is, it didn't cost Jack the South, no. Instead, it won him the solid support of the black people throughout the land. And without all those black votes, he would not have been elected. All of which proves there are times when the political expedient is the morally wise. Right, Jack?
Yes, Reverend. Once in a very great while. The campaign approached its climax. I hopscotched across America working as hard as any mortal could. Bobby, my manager, worked harder. He is the greatest man I ever knew. Over and over, showing I could be as tough as Nikita Khrushchev, I told the American people, "The world cannot exist half slave and half free," subtly comparing myself to Lincoln. Even more subtly conjuring Nixon, who was out there campaigning half-shaved and half-frizz. I spoke of the need for expanding educational opportunity to everyone. I spoke of the need to end poverty. Over and over, I played the theme of getting America moving again. And America responded. On election night, we all gathered at the compound in Hyannisport to watch the returns. Bobby's large house had been turned into Election Central with dozens of TV sets, telephones, calculators. Wires crisscrossed the floors. The whole family and some of our closest friends were in the house, munching sandwiches, staring at the TV sets as the returns began to trickle in. Upstairs, in the pointy attic, Pop manned his own battery of private phones, like a Boston Irish fiddler on the roof. The early returns looked good. By 8 p.m., the central computer we'd installed in Bobby's living room was predicting I would win the election with 51% of the vote. The family was jubilant, my sisters jumping up and down, the servants handing out drinks. I knew it was too early, of course. The returns were mostly from the East, the region of my greatest strength. The Pennsylvania returns came in, a solid majority for us. The industrial states began to come in, and they appeared strong for us. A few minutes later came the word that Ohio was going for Nixon, and then Kentucky, Tennessee, Wisconsin, the whole damn farm belt. The victory was disappearing before our eyes. Upstairs, in his private attic, the fiddler on the roof fiddled with his private phones. The mood was growing ominous. Texas and Illinois were running too close to call, and we'd probably have to win both to win the election. A telephone in the den rang. One of the kids answered it. It was for Uncle Jack. I went to the phone and listened over the din.
Mr. Kennedy?
Yes?
This is Judy from Time Magazine. We're having a special election night subscription drive. A one-year subscription for just 33 cents an issue. And as a bonus, you get a free Polaroid camera.
I said I was not interested. Then I told Bobby I needed to get away from the crowd. I needed to walk on the beach to collect my thoughts. I saw the oceanfront cottage. The only light was from a kerosene lantern, the kind that the wives of sailors used to keep burning to await their husband's return from the sea. Judy was wearing a new negligee for the occasion. It was black and very sheer, except for three appliques sewn on in strategic places. Covering each breast was a small donkey. Covering her nether region was a campaign slogan, "All the way with JFK. The negligee had been a gift, she said, from her thoughtful friend, Sam Flood. Judy wasted little time. Just as I thought I couldn't stand it any longer, the princess phone beside the bed rang. Bobby had been kind enough to have one installed for the evening. It was Lyndon, being patched through from his ranch. Yes, Lyndon. I pushed at Judy's dark head. Judy didn't stop working.
I just wanted to tell you, Jack, said Lyndon. Texas is going to be close, but safe.
It was well past midnight when I got back to the election central. The kids had been put to bed, but everyone else was still there. The mood was quiet, weary. The election was still up in the air. Winning or losing, it appeared, would depend on Illinois, where Nixon and I were neck and neck. I ate a sandwich and drank a beer. I asked Bobby where Pop was. Pop was still up in the attic, he said, fiddling. At 3:30 in the morning, I had 261 electoral votes, but I needed eight more to win, and there was no guarantee that I would get them. Nixon went on television from the West Coast, looking worn as an old cloth coat. We hoped he might be conceding, but he didn't. I told the others I was going to bed. Win or lose, I would still be alive in the morning. Tired and alone, I walked down the beach to the isolated cottage in the dunes. There I did go to bed with Marilyn, or tried to. At my request, she was wearing her Runnin' Wild dress from Some Like It Hot. She had recently split with her husband, and this would be our first time alone together, our first night of love. The dress would honor that afternoon we had first met more than 2 years earlier. I took her hand. I kissed it. We let our lips touch, lightly. I slumped into a chair, weary. Marilyn could see that I needed stimulation. She bent over, opened my zipper, providing breathing room. Then she backed away. She stood about 8 feet in front of me, and in the dim light, ever so slowly, she began to undress herself, to remove as slowly and excruciatingly as a stripper the sequined dress, under which there was nothing. The world's most sexiest movie queen. I had the strangest thought, if my dad could see me now. Slowly, ever so, Marilyn's flesh appeared. First one soft, glowing breast, then the other. Slowly, ever so, she wriggled the gown down over her hips. All the while, her eyes were trained on me. Not on my face, but on the appendage protruding from my pants. I could see where her eyes were. They burned there like a laser beam on my renewing strength. The phone rang. I reached across for it. Marilyn, as if a petulant, speeded up her undulating wiggling. It was Bobby on the phone. Pop had just talked to Mayor Daley, he said. We were going to carry Illinois, Daley had said, with a little help from our friends. Just as he spoke the word, friends, Marilyn dropped her dress. In the pale light, I was staring at the hitherto forbidden brownness, goldness of her. I awoke in my own cottage at 7:30 in the morning and was informed officially that I was president-elect of the United States. I stepped outside into the crisp November air. The house was surrounded by agents of the Secret Service. I took a stroll along the beach, watching the cold blue waves roll in. The beach, too, was lined with agents. I breakfasted with Jackie and Caroline. the president-elect as loving husband, loving father. Then, for most of the day, Bobby and Pop and a few of the others analyzed the vote. In the Electoral College, I'd received 303 votes to Nixon's 219, an apparently solid victory. But if Texas and Illinois had gone the other way, I'd have lost the election. In the vast and glorious state of Texas, I had won by the width of a mosquito's ass, 46,000 votes. And this, as I've mentioned earlier, only after Lyndon's people got a whole passel of Nixon votes disqualified. My margin in Illinois was only 8,858 votes. How many of those were the votes of dogs, cats, canaries, wharf rats, and the honorable deceased, I cannot say for sure. All I know is that every time a block of Nixon votes came in from the Republicans downstate, Mayor Daley counted with a bigger block of his own. The winning votes, it turned out, came from Chicago's West Side River wards. Mayor Daley was the boss of Chicago, but he was not the boss of the river wards. In the 1920s, the only boss there had been Al Capone. In the 1930s, Frank Nitti, and onward through the begets of Murder Incorporated until, in 1960, the one and only boss of the river wards, the man who told people how to vote and how often to vote and how to count the votes, was none other than Salvatore Momo Giancana. If I was celebrating modestly that morning, Sam Giancana was ecstatic. His most powerful enemy in the world, who had been harassing him in Congress for 2 years, was Robert Kennedy. Momo had just helped elect Robert's older brother president. His dear friend Judy Campbell was sleeping with me, a fact we would rather the nation's press not ascertain. In addition, he was under contract with the government itself, through the CIA, to kill Fidel Castro, another fact the government would prefer remain secret. If ever, in the history of the universe, a mobster could feel free of the threat of further harassment, it was Sam Momo Giancana that day. In the days after the election, there were widespread reports of shenanigans in Illinois. Nixon was urged to contest the election. He never did. People assumed it was because he was a good sport, because he did not want to hurt the country. Whatever the 5 o'clock shadowy reason, Richard Nixon did not protest. The election landslide stood. And so it came to pass that on a cold day in January 1961, I was sworn in as the 35th President of the United States. Let the word go forth from this time and place. For the third time that penultimate day, we were airborne, droning through the Texas night from Houston to Fort Worth. After the election and a few days of swimming in Palm Beach, my thoughts turned toward the staffing of the new government. I instructed my aides to scour the land. I wanted none but the brightest and the best. First, I would deal with the FBI and the CIA, then choose a cabinet. Most people, including my closest friends, urged me to get rid of Hoover and assumed I would. The FBI needed to be swept clean, they said. I agreed with all my heart, and then I made J. Edgar Hoover my first reappointment, an act more accurately of high treason and of self-preservation. Hoover still had, at the tip of his pudgy fingers, the secret Inga tapes, and God knows how many others. Most people, including my closest friends, also urged me to get rid of Alan Dulles at CIA, a stodgy holdover from the old guard. I reappointed Dulles, too. What no one knew was what Dulles had told me in a top-secret briefing after the election. He told me that the agency had for months been secretly training an army of anti-Castro Cubans. This army, he said, would soon invade Cuba. The faithful populace there would rally to its side, Fidel Castro would be toppled, and a government friendly to the United States would rise like old glory in his place. As Dulles revealed this plan to me in the Oval Office, it sounded like music to my ears, like the Star Spangled Banner, to be precise. Only later did I learn that a CIA microstereo implanted in the director's right testicle was in fact playing the national anthem all through our discussion, at a pitch too high for the human ear to hear, but not too high for the human gut. The invasion plan, since it would merely set Cuban against Cuban and cost no American blood, sounded, against the stirring anthem, like a fine idea, worthy, in fact, of Pop. Getting rid of Castro as my first act of foreign policy would be a political tonic at home and a warning to the commies around the world that Kennedy played tackle, not touch.
In addition, the plan had been pre-approved by Ike. Who was I to countermand the hero of D-Day? When I'd filled out my cabinet, only Justice was left. Pop had been lobbying for Bobby for months, but Bobby wasn't interested. He did not want to spend his whole life in my shadow, he said. He did not want to work in the White House taking orders from me or in the cabinet. What he wanted to do, he said, was to go back to Massachusetts, run for governor, carve out a career of his own. Besides, he said, all hell would break loose if I named him AG. People would cry nepotism. They would say he was too young, that he was not qualified. All this I understand, but in the end, I decided I needed him. Most of the others I'd picked were not cronies. I didn't know them. By reputation, they had brains and talent, but I also needed someone I could trust completely. And so, one fine December day, I twisted Bobby's arm, almost literally. I made the announcement in front of the Georgetown house, Bobby standing beside me, his little boy's tousled hair blowing in the wind. The ensuing public relations storm was predictable and short-lived. Surprisingly, Bobby got most of the flack, as if he had demonstrated his unfitness for the job by accepting it. Historians since have noted that it was probably my best appointment. It was also a fateful one. What a conflagration swept through the underworld. Here, they reasoned, they had used good mob money, good mob singers, to elect Jack Kennedy president. They didn't like me, but they figured they could live with me. They figured they understood me. They figured they could use me, especially since Judy had plenty of cleavage in which to carry messages. But Bobby, as attorney general, that they hadn't counted on. Bobby was their public enemy number one. Since Hoover's official stance at the FBI was still that the mob was, like the unicorn, a mythical beast, Bobby created the Organized Crime Task Force within the Justice Department. He staffed it with the best investigators he could find, and he drew up a list of men they needed to go after. Right at the top was Sam Momo Giancana, followed almost immediately by Johnny Rosselli, Santo Trafficante, and Carlos Marcello. Bobby told his investigators he didn't care what they got them for. If it wasn't murder or extortion, get them for tax evasion, for traffic violations, for pulling the do-not-remove tags off mattresses, anything that they could make stick. Pop was of the opinion that Bobby was being a poor sport. A man makes a sizable contribution to your campaign, you can overlook a few business-like murders. But Bobby was tenacious. Once he took the job, he was going to be the damnedest AG in history. Seated behind a large desk that Jackie found in the White House basement and had refinished, I turned my attention to foreign policy. The Cuban defense plan was a simple one. Against the mighty Goliath of the United States, the Cuban dictator would use a young shepherd boy, David Gonzalez. All along Cuba's coastline, Castro had built enormous holding pens. These pens were filled with hundreds of thousands of pigs. As the invasion fleet, having set sail from a not-so-secret base in Guatemala, began to enter Cuban waters, the shepherd David moved along the line of pens, opening the gates. As each gate was opened, tens of thousands of pigs spilled out onto the beaches and into the shallow waters. Before long, the entire bay where the invasion fleet was to come ashore was a grunting, squealing mass of slippery pigs. There was no room for the landing craft to enter. They kept bumping into masses of 400-pound pigs. There was no way for the invaders to cross the beaches. Instead of sand underfoot, there were massed pigs. The invaders could get no purchase on the backs of the wet, slimy hogs. They kept slipping off and getting trampled. They had brought plenty of ammunition, but it was being absorbed by the fleshy, pink, porcine flanks. By nightfall, not a single invader had crossed the beach, and the only Cuban casualty was a BLT. The Cubans protested the attempted invasion to the United Nations. Adlai, our ambassador, made a ringing denial that the United States was in any way involved. We had never told poor Adlai, and now how could we? How could we admit that this ludicrous operation, apparently spawned by the insane, had actually come out of the bowels of the Central Intelligence Agency? In the war room that night, the agency argued for further escalation of the plan. Drop napalm on the Cuban pigs, they argued. Throw the fat in the fire, or vice versa. I refused. I called the whole thing off.
and took the blame. That is the first thing I learned as president. It is the very lesson that Nixon refused to learn and which brought him down. It should be rule number one in the guidebook for presidents. If you don't want the truth to come out, take the blame. So I took the blame for the Bay of Pigs, so much so that it has become almost a generic term now. Rare is the man who doesn't somehow have his Bay of Pigs under one name or another. November 21st became November 22nd at the Texas Hotel in Fort Worth, where we arrived shortly before midnight. Jackie, tired from the long all-day campaign, retired directly to her bedroom as always. Her lady-in-waiting, Minerva Cheevy, unpacked her suitcase, hung up the pink suit she'd be wearing in the morning, placed her favorite stuffed horse on her pillow. At my end of the suite, I kicked off my shoes, put my feet up on an ottoman, quaffed a cold bottle of Corona while Raymond drew my bath. While I was preoccupied with foreign policy, Bobby, over at Justice, was pursuing his attack on crime. His first major move was against one of the most vicious and most powerful, but one of the least known mob bosses in America. His name was Carlos Marcello. Carlos, based in New Orleans, was the godfather of the South and Southwest. He owned half the sheriffs, mayors, and judges in Louisiana, and a good many in Texas as well. His organization did a $1 billion-a-year business in heroin, cocaine, prostitution, hijacking, and modern jazz. He lived on a sprawling $22 million estate surrounded by hundreds of bougainvillea bushes and thousands of Dobermans. Bobby, of course, terrier that he was, could not resist going after Carlos Marcello. Born in Tunisia of Sicilian parents, Marcello had been brought to the United States as an infant, but he had never become a naturalized citizen. He lived under a Guatemalan passport, which he reportedly had gotten by bribing a Guatemalan leader with $100,000. He was, therefore, an illegal alien, and Bobby moved to get him deported. In the spring of 1961, when Marcello showed up for his quarterly check-in with the local immigration office, he was arrested and handcuffed. He was taken directly to the airport where a U.S. Border Patrol plane was waiting, its engines revved. The plane flew him to Guatemala City, where he was left with no luggage and little money. Soon after, the president of Guatemala ordered him expelled and had him flown to the jungles of El Salvador. There, he was deposited among the silent vines and the chattering monkeys in his Italian silk suit and two-toned shoes, 30 miles from the nearest village. Marcello began to walk. The swampy jungle floor oozed into his shoes, causing blisters on his feet. As luck would have it, he happened upon a jungle stream in which an alligator was dozing. Marcello, using the stealth he had learned years before as a wise guy on Bourbon Street, sneaked up on the alligator unawares and bit off his tail. After sucking the blood to quench his hunger and thirst, he sat on a moss-covered log and made himself some alligator shoes. While Marcello plied his father's old craft, the tailless alligator slithered around behind the log and bit off a piece of Marcello's ass. As the mobster groaned in agony, a monkey began to chatter in the trees above. He was making monkey sounds, but Marcello, in what he would later describe as a religious miracle, understood the instructive words. "If you want to get an alligator's tail," the monkey said from the treetops, "you don't bite off his tail. What you do is bite off his head. Then the tail will die." Marcello pondered these words of wisdom in the halo of an epiphany. A great smile split his face. "It's obvious what the monkey meant, right?" Bobby exclaimed. "Marcello was furious at me for harassing him, for having him deported without warning. He blamed me for his ignominious exile in the jungle. He wanted to see me dead. Then this monkey, which just happens to be passing, tells him how to go about it. I'm the tail, right? And you're the head, Jack? If he has me killed, the Attorney General, you, as president, will just go after him with even greater vigor. You'll bite off the other half of his ass. But if he kills you, the head, then Lyndon will take over, and I will be powerless. He'll get the head and tail both by killing you. Thus spaketh the monkey, correct, Jack?" "Well, let's assume your interpretation is correct, Bobby, for the purpose of this discussion." "Assume? Well, what else could the monkey have meant?
It just as clearly could have been referring to the commies, I point out. Marcello hated Castro. He and his buddies in Florida, Myelansky and Santo Traficante, had lost a fortune in gambling money when Castro shut down the casinos in Havana. We know they'd been trying, without success, to kill Castro at the instigation of the CIA. Suppose this is what the monkey is telling him. If you kill Castro, some other revolutionary, like his brother Raul or Che Guevara, will take his place. You won't have gained a thing. But if you kill the head, if you kill the puppet master, Khrushchev, then the puppet will wither and die. The interpretation makes just as much sense. Except, Bobby countered, that is not borne out by history. Nobody killed Khrushchev. Late in the spring of 1962, my 45th birthday was celebrated with a massive, star-studded, as they say, fundraising party in New York's Madison Square Garden. The surprise of the evening was when Marilyn stepped out of the shadows and into the spotlight. Her last wild, symbolic act, to sing Happy Birthday to me. She stood, not 10 feet from me, in the center of the boxing ring, before 20,000 people, wearing a low-cut white evening gown, flaunting our unspoken affair before the world. It was that outrageous act, I suspect, that pushed them over the edge. All of them. It happened 2 months later, 5 August 1962, one of those typically American nights when everyone, afterward, for the rest of their lives, would remember what they were doing. I was screwing someone, I recall. It is just her name that escapes. In California, it was a hot and sultry night. Some like it hot, but not Marilyn. Oppressed by the heat and the humidity, she was walking about naked in the secluded cottage on the secluded estate where she was staying. No one would find her here. No one would intrude on her privacy. She could be the nature girl that was part of her. In a glass pitcher on the table beside her bed was a batch of vodka and tonic she had mixed, dozens of ice cubes floating on the surface like a flotilla of PT boats. Beside the pitcher was a worn copy of Anna Karenina, one of the Russian novels she loved so much. As she emerged from the bathroom, she heard a faint knock on the door. She was surprised, but not startled. She had heard no one approach, and the cottage appeared on no map and was far from any public roadway. If she had been Lady Chatterley, a book she had recently read, she would have assumed it was the gamekeeper come for another tumble. As it was, she assumed it was a servant come down from the main house a quarter of a mile away beyond the rolling hills and lawns with a message that someone somewhere felt was important. Marilyn that summer felt that little in life was important. She was trying desperately to wean herself from tranquilizers, less desperately from alcohol. It would later be put about that she had tried suicide several times in the preceding months. These reports I tend not to believe, because she had so much to give the world, and because she told me they weren't true. At the second light knock, she grabbed a thin robe from the back of a chair and slipped her still fine body into it. This was more an act of propriety than of modesty. The robe consisted of two filmy layers of pale blue chiffon, which concealed almost nothing. A barefoot California girl, weary before her time, she moved toward the door, then stopped as it began to swing open. She hadn't locked it, and saw no need to in this secluded place. A reading lamp was on in the living room. By its dim glow across the room, she saw two figures moving in behind the slowly opening door. Women who seemed to be trying to be stealthy and yet who were also stumbling over each other. They reminded her of people from the past, a thought she could not pin down. Her normal response with strangers was politeness. She was taken aback, however, by this quiet barging in.
I beg your pardon. Are you looking for someone? For you,
the first woman said, as the second closed the door behind them. Together, side by side, they moved closer to her. Marilyn, seeing their faces, stood transfixed. The night was young. She'd only had a drink or two, three at the most.
I'm Jackie. I'm Ethel.
Marilyn stood wide-eyed. Then she stammered.
Yes, I see. Won't you come in?
And like a character from one of her films, she said,
But you're already in, aren't you?
Like most Americans, she had seen countless pictures of Jackie and Ethel, but she had never met either of them before.
She could only guess at how they had found the place or what they wanted from her. She didn't have long to find out.
I understand you've been sleeping with my husband.
Marilyn looked with astonishment at the first lady, who seemed dressed for a cooler evening, in purple slacks, a pink long-sleeved blouse, white gloves, and purple heels. But she was a quick study. If they were really going to play the scene, she thought, it could only be played for laughs.
Actually, we haven't found much time for sleeping.
You know what I mean. You've been fucking him all over the East Coast.
The common obscenity sounded dirty the way Jackie said it.
Somebody has to,
Marilyn said in a sweet tone, then turning toward Ethel, the other Kennedy.
And you, what is your complaint?
My husband loves you?
Yes.
Then why don't you sleep with him?
Is that what you would like me to do, sleep with Bobby?
You're damn right it is. Get this obsession out of his mind once and for all.
Marilyn stood there, looking from one to the other, confused.
If you ladies could get your act together and come up with a suitable plan, perhaps we could work this out.
Now it was Jackie and Ethel who looked at each other. Jackie spoke first.
As a matter of fact, we do have a plan. That's why we're here.
Now, hold on a minute, Jack,
Lyndon interjects.
The way I hear it, the way I saw it, Jackie and Ethel hated each other. Why, they couldn't work together for the March of Dimes, let alone on some private business.
If you'll let me continue, the story will illuminate itself, Lyndon. Jackie and Ethel began moving toward Marilyn, as if, indeed, by some prearrangement. Marilyn slowly backed up toward the bedroom. As she did, she had the same fleeting thought that she'd had earlier, that she had seen these people before. They exuded menace as they moved her into the bedroom. At the same time, they were comical in their walk, as if they weren't used to high heels.
They are men, Jack,
the precise thought that Marilyn suddenly had. They were men in drag, like Tony and Jack in the movie. They were merely wearing Ethel and Jackie masks. She could see that now in the bedroom where the overhead light was on, and they clearly meant her no good. She thought of screaming, but didn't. No one would hear her from the isolated cottage. She continued to back away from their advance. The back of her legs touched the bed. Jackie moved forward, shoved her roughly on it. Ethel grabbed her head, held it in a powerful grip. Jackie reached for the pitcher on the table. Ethel forced her mouth, and Marilyn gagged and swallowed, gagged again as Jackie poured the icy vodka tonics down her throat. She tried to struggle away, but she couldn't. They were stronger than she. Her robe came open, leaving her half naked. The others didn't seem to notice. "The pills," she heard Jackie say. Jackie reached into her purse, pulled out a prescription bottle. She opened it, began to pour a stream of small white pills down Marilyn's throat. They held her in a tight grasp till Marilyn no longer struggled, till her eyes closed, till she went limp. They let her go then and left her there, like a beautiful corpse on a paperback cover, sprawled across the bed. Jackie lifted the receiver from the princess phone by the bed. She placed it on the floor near Marilyn's dangling hand. They looked around, making sure that everything was in order. As they did, they heard footsteps outside. They floundered on high heels across the living room, burst out the door, ran as best they could into a copse of woods behind the cabin. A small, slim man who had been walking on the gravel path toward the cabin suddenly stopped when he heard the commotion. He saw two figures burst through the door and disappear out back. In the moonless night, all he saw was their shapes. He waited till there was silence, till they were gone, till the only sound was a whippoorwill singing in the brush behind him. Then, quietly, he slipped in through the open door.
And?
And what, Lyndon?
What happened next? Who was the man? Why did you stop?
This is the end of the chapter, Lyndon.
What? You can't do that. You can't leave us hanging like that.
I'm gratified to learn that even Lyndon doesn't know the truth of this scene.
Oh, Seekers, there was part two of I, JFK by Robert Mayer. And you still have one more big chunk of it to look forward to. Good night, Seekers.